Tonight on Arena, museums and art galleries reopened to the public today. How has it all been going? And Gary Hines and Peter Daly on a virtual version of Druid Debuts. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, as you've been hearing on the news, kind of freedom at last, isn't it? Today, not only could you jump in your car, drive across the country, get a haircut, sit inside and have your paid-for meal, and maybe now you're thinking about going for a pint, or perhaps to the gym, the more fit amongst you. But with all of us starved for a first-hand experience with culture, today you could go back into galleries, libraries and museums. Kay Sheehy's decided to forgo the haircut and the hairdo and decided to satiate her cultural appetite instead. What about the cultural world? As exciting as the hairdressing world, was there much of a buzz about today, Kay?
Well, I'd say there wasn't the same level of desperation or unruly locks. So I don't think there was any now midnight openings like there were in barbershops or queues around the block. But after a while, I did begin to think that there was a real genuine excitement about connecting with the real thing after being online for so long, connecting with the work of art or of a historical document. So all across the country, galleries and museums are opening up. In the new Taoiseach's home, Cork, the Crawford Gallery opened. Limerick City Gallery opened today, and the Hunt Museum, also in Limerick, opens tomorrow. Not all the museums and galleries are open yet. For example, the Butler in Kilkenny is closed until August. Visual in Carlo and the Model in Sligo both are open on July the 23rd. So you'd need to check before you go. But the National Museum in Collins Barracks and in Mayo, that's the Folklore Museum, are open, as is the National Gallery. And I went to the National Gallery in Merrion Square. It opened this morning through the Clare Street entrance, and the rooms, there's just a number of rooms in the Millennium Wing at the moment open to the public. And there I met a few visitors, and I met the head of operations, Christian Clothworthy, who explained the layout to me.
We had started off with a plan to open fully on the 20th of July. That time frame got brought forward, and so what we did do then was open the shop first with entrance in from here on Clare Street, and now today 1 to 5 have opened up.
So why did you decide 1 to 5? And for those who don't know 1 to 5, they're the ones at the top of the stairs.
At the moment, there was an awful lot of control measures that had to be put into a building of this, or buildings of this size. And when the time frame was brought forward, the installation schedules had to be changed. So we prioritised the Millennium Wing entrance while we're continuing to do back of house works elsewhere in preparation for getting those spaces open. And we're going to have a scaling up of that reopening up to the 20th of July now, as more and more spaces within the gallery become available. And shortly we'll open up a one-way system from Merrion Square through, and we'll actually exit from here. We are allowing self-navigation within the gallery, so we're not giving it a strict one-way system, because the galleries are so spacious generally that 2 metre distancing is generally quite possible throughout the space. The public spaces are actually the easiest element to prepare. It's really about signage and ensuring that we can maintain the distancing. The real problems for us are actually the back-of-house spaces where our staff are, locker facilities, canteens, things like that. So in fact we've installed new welfare facilities back of house, so that's all of the unseen element of it.
So I find you here in the European room.
Yeah.
So what have you been looking at?
Well, we've looked at some Rodin, some Monet, some Renoir. There's been a lot of famous artists here that I didn't realise were here. It's amazing.
Are you an art fan? Have you been dying to get some art under your belt while you've been in lockdown?
No, I like coming here. I wouldn't consider myself a huge art fan or anything like, but I like coming here every now and then. I like this one by Breton.
Oh yes, that's the Gleaners.
It's really, really detailed.
I did an internship here, so now my internship has ended, so now I am a tourist here, trying to enjoy Ireland as much as I can.
Okay, so were you thrilled to find out that the gallery was open?
Yeah, because I don't really have a routine now that my internship has ended. So yeah, now it's good that there is something to see again.
what are you looking forward to seeing, or do you know anything about the collection?
No, but that's actually why I decided to come, because I like to be surprised.
There you go. Some members of the public there visiting the National Gallery today and speaking to Keshi. It's actually beautiful to hear that echoey sound that we get when we go out into the gallery and the sense of occasion of just being there. Did you find, I know you were working today, Kay, but did you find yourself pausing and looking at paintings and maybe saying, oh, it's just great to see the real thing for a change?
Oh, very much so. It was so exciting to get in the Clare Street entrance, to see the shop, all the beautiful display in the shop, which is even hinting at what's going to be opening in July, let's say the Caravaggios and everything. And then going up the stairs and seeing, you know, all those classic impressionist work that they have in the Millennium Wing. It was really, really exciting. As you heard from that man I spoke to was up from Waterford, and he was just so happy to be in there just looking at paintings.
I know it is great that people can get back into there. But you went on several visits today. I know you're going to make your way to the National Library, but you do so by way of a few private galleries.
Yeah, I dropped into the Carlin Gallery, which is showing the work of Richard Gorman, who is known for his colourful geometric shapes. And his show, Dawkey, had been on in the Carlin before COVID struck. Well, Richard is back in the Carlin, which they thought with Dawkey. But in fact, while he was in lockdown, he painted a completely new set of paintings. And now it's called Dawkey 2. And it looks fantastic in the gallery. Big, large geometric works. Then I went to the library, which looked exactly the same. The beautiful reading room was not divided up with yellow COVID lines, because they've decided to do is to allow readers in by making appointments online. So the National Library's director, Sandra Collins, explained.
So our focus has been on limiting and managing the number of people that access the system at a time. So we've reduced the number of readers that can come into the space, but when they come into the reading room, then they have really the same service. So they're spaced 2 metres apart, they book their appointment in advance, they have their desk for the full day, the library staff retrieve the materials that they've ordered, they're waiting on the reader's desk when they come in, and then they have that experience of that beautiful space, the materials from the collections. They have it for the full day, the peace and quiet, you know, the very special shush of the room. I love the sound of it. It's a quality of silence.
So then they give their book or their documents back. What happens then, Sandra, with those books and documents?
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're implementing international best practice on the quarantine of library materials. And that says that for 72 hours you quarantine the materials, and the virus naturally dies off over that period if it had touched the contact. Now, that's a conservative measure, I would say. It may be that 24 hours would manage for paper, but we're putting the safety of our readers and our staff right at the heart of everything we do. So if somebody comes in and they take a reference book off the shelf, that's absolutely fine. We ask them to put it back in a space that we've designated for used materials. It'll sit and quarantine for 72 hours, then it goes back into the collections and can be used again. So for anybody that wants to come to the library, go onto the website www.nli.ie, and from there you will either book an appointment for the reader services, so the manuscript or the main reading room or the family history service, or you can book a visit, a tour of the Seamus Heaney exhibition. And later in July, on the 20th of July, we'll be reopening the W.B. Yeats exhibition as well. The cafe is open on a drop-in service, and we hope people will, like, Kildare Street seems so quiet and empty at the moment, so I really hope as people are coming back into their offices and their shops that they'll pop in and have a coffee and a scone in our lovely cafe.
So that's Sandra Collins of the National Library. Then I went to the manuscript room in the National Library, where I found historian Mary McAuliffe, who was delighted to be back there.
Well, I use both the reading room up in the main library, and obviously here are the manuscripts. They have so many collections that are of importance to my work on revolutionary women and suffrage women. So great joy to come back in here this morning.
Now, Sandra was saying that there's so much available online, but I guess when you're digging deep like you do, you really have to get in there and find the material.
Oh, absolutely. Well, some of the material I was looking at this morning is not available online and I had to come in. But, you know, the very fact of actually handling the papers, the letters that people wrote, you might miss something in your analysis of it or your reading of it.
So can you share with us something you've been looking at?
Well, very exciting, actually. I had a very fruitful day. I am writing an article on the same-sex relationships between revolutionary women and suffrage women in the first two decades. And so I have names. And I found some love letters between two women. I can't share it all now because I haven't written it yet. But they both of them were involved in cultural nationalism, both of them suffragettes. And there were the love letters. They arranged to meet one evening at the front gate of Trinity, where many romances began, I suppose, over the decades, over the centuries. And I found that wasn't the only find, though. I found other letters in another collection between two other women, one an American feminist activist and one an Irish cultural nationalist, who had a brief relationship between 1919, 1920. And that wasn't the only material I found today. So it's been a really, really fruitful day. And I can almost see the piece I'm writing coming together already. And it just being back here, it's been an itch I've wanted to scratch to get back into research and writing. And 3 long months of not being able to go into an archive for a historian is purgatory.
That's Mary McAuliffe there in the manuscript room of the National Library speaking with Kay Sheehy. That story that she is uncovering, Kay, it does sound very exciting. Could you get anything? She wouldn't give you any hint as to who those two big figures were that
she
was
talking about?
I'm
sworn to silence. Of course I got it out of her, but she wouldn't allow me to say.
All right. Did you bribe her with a scone? I was delighted to hear that the cafe was open and you can actually...
And the other thing, I know it's not very artistic, but the loos are open. You know, the wonderful loos in the National Library? They're open and the loos in the National Gallery are open.
Well, you know,
always useful.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a very practical thing and it has become a difficulty for people when they're out and about. And now that they'll be out and about more, that is good to know. Well, I'm glad you had a nice assignment on that one today, Kay. It must have been
Indeed. Great
to get around.
And actually,
to those venues.
In the National Library, they were saying that many of the talks that they have put online that normally would be, you know, people coming to the library to hear have become so popular. And they're thinking that that's something that they've learned about that hunger there is for more online content.
Well, that's a good thing, too, I guess. You know, there were bad things to the lockdown, but good things will come out of it as well.
Yeah.
That's Kay Sheehy reporting to us there on her visit around some of the galleries that are opened in Dublin at the moment. And as Kay was telling us about various places around the country opening on, you do need to check with the venue as to whether you need to book, all that type of thing. It will probably vary from venue to venue for a period of time, so don't just turn up at the door because you could be disappointed. Power of Dreams were a three-piece guitar band from Dublin, emerged as part of a wave of new Irish talent in the early 1990s. Their debut album, Immigrants, Emigrants and Me, became one of the most acclaimed releases from any Irish band during that era. Well, Power of Dreams are back, fronted once again by Craig Walker, now based in Berlin, and one half of the duo, The Them There, who we welcomed for Arena, in fact, a session a couple of years back, if I remember right. But Power of Dreams have a new album on the way. Keep you posted on that. But in the meantime, here's one track from a double A-side single, which will be released this Friday. I think this is the first play it's getting, in fact, on RTE Radio 1. This is America. America from Power of Dreams. Every summer, as part of the Galway International Arts Festival, Druid Theatre Company produces rehearsed readings entitled Druid Debuts. The project means that up-and-coming playwrights get a chance to have their work given a public airing with professional support. Amongst the great previous successes of the series was Sonia Kelly's play Furniture, which moved on to full production and subsequently toured around Ireland to great acclaim in 2019. This July, there are four Druid debuts to look forward to. And as with many festival events this year, they're moving online. So to tell us more, I'm joined by Gary Hines from Druid and one of the playwrights involved, Peter Daly. Just before we get to the debuts themselves, it has been the oddest of years, Gary. What has the atmosphere been like in Druid, trying to keep spirits up at a time when you can't perform at all in a theatre?
Oh, it's been very strange. I mean, I could never have imagined anything like it in my lifetime. Just the fact that we couldn't do the very basic thing that we're here to do, which is assemble, whether it be with a cast of 10 or a cast of 100 or an audience of 10 or an audience of 1, just come together to do what we basically do, that we couldn't even do that. It's been very, very strange. But I suppose, like everybody, we're learning to adjust. We're learning to be creative and reimagine and do different things. But I think at the bottom of it, in as much as we love being able to do what we're doing now, we can't wait really to get back to live performance. Yeah.
You were mid-production with The Cherry Orchard in March when the lockdown took effect.
That's right.
Is that production now, does that just die when that happens?
Well, I mean, we basically had finished our Galway run. We had done the live streaming, the live broadcast of it, and we were looking forward to performing in Dublin and at the Edinburgh Festival. But obviously, both of those have been cancelled. So it's hard to say what the future might be, because we're still trying to imagine what that future is. I mean, when are we going to get back to being able to play to a full house in a theatre? It's very hard to know. So meanwhile, we're making plans to try and perform within the government guidelines, to try and bring people together for theatre within the government guidelines. So that, you know, in the early days, we were in a situation of making plans, then having to remake them, then making them and having to remake them. So right now we're saying, right, we within whatever the guidelines are right now, that's what we're going to do.
And Peter Daly, you were actually part of that production of The Cherry Orchard. You're a freelancer. So it's not just, oh, I don't have work to go to today. It's, I also don't have any money coming in. Were there big financial implications for you as a freelancer?
I think there were for everybody, really. I mean, anybody who knows me well enough knows I have a sideline, which is accountancy. I think we talked about this the last time I was on your show with money. I kind of kept that trucking along. Other people in the industry got the COVID pandemic unemployment payment. But yeah, things were bleak beforehand, to be honest, Sean. And they're not looking great for the future, because it's hard to know, as Gary says, when we're going to get people back in a room together. It's tricky. It's very tricky.
And presumably you could keep members of the company, including the acting company that you have, Gary, could you keep them active in terms of payroll, in terms of the COVID payment, but you couldn't do that for freelancers? Was that how it worked?
Well, no, not even the acting company. I mean, the ensemble is a group of people together who agree to be part of the process of an ensemble, but they're only paid when they're actually acting with the company. They're not paid through the year. I don't know if there's any companies that are hired year round, certainly not in the European context that we are used to, not in the UK, not in Ireland, perhaps in Germany, they still maintain them. But other than that, no. So all the ensemble actors are freelance unless they're actually acting in a Druid production. And so everybody faced that. It exposed really how incredible. I mean, we in the business know how precarious the industry is, but this just exposed it for, you know, how much it's on a knife edge, and it was very, very, very worrying.
Yeah, and I suppose given the fact that we do now have a new Minister for the Arts, we do now have a new government, and I know there was some money that was 25 million passed on to the Arts Council. What would you like to see happening that would make that facility for the acting, for the artists, let's face it, the people who are up there night after night, for the acting ensemble, for freelancers like Peter, what would you like to the see the government doing, this new government doing, to help that situation?
I think the government has to look, and the Arts Council has to look at the ecosystem. The fact of the matter is that, you know, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but 70-80% of all people who work in the theatre industry are freelance actors. Now, that's quite extraordinary. We are very grateful for the 25 million, but that really is bringing the Arts Council only up to a level that the council and we in the industry have been looking for the last 20, 25 years. There needs to be a real investment on the basis of the industry. It needs to be a sort of commitment, not something that people take at the expense of their lives or supporting their families, or, as Peter said, they're just looking at this incredibly bleak future. That's if we value arts and culture as much as we do, as much as we say we do, then we have to support it in the same way.
Yeah, and this is the period when everybody said, isn't it great that we have our culture to sustain us? And I know the reaction we've been getting on the programme for the past 3-4 months about just keeping things going and giving some people some fodder for the mind and for the soul. You know, let's ask people to put their money where their mouth is regarding their value on culture. But let's move on anyway to the Druid debuts, and specifically, Peter, to a bit of work that you are doing right now, which must be good a good feeling to have. There were 400. I'll come back to Gary on this in a second, but to you first, Peter, there were 400 submissions for these Druid debuts this year. There were 4 plays chosen.
Yeah.
That it may not put rent immediately, or may not pay the rent or pay the mortgage immediately, but there must be a good feeling when you get that kind of affirmation.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I put the play into the Druids open writing submission, which is open at the moment again for next year. And I suppose it was a good 6 months later, I got the email, and there'd been no indication in between that it was making its way through different readers and so forth. So it was a huge... like my jaw literally hit the table as I was looking at the laptop when the email came through to say they had chosen. It was amazing. It's the first full-length play with lots of different people in it that I've written on my own. I'd co-written something and I'd written a one-man show. So, yeah, it was a great feeling. And then when Brian, the producer, told me there had been over 400 submissions, I have to say I was walking on air for a short while after that. Then I came right back down when I realised I still had a couple of rewrites to do before we stick it on in 3 weeks' time.
Yeah, and Aaron Monaghan will be directing that piece as well. Gary, 4 out of 400. That's first of all, it's a huge number of submissions. I'm sure. Right. I don't know what the quality was like across those 400, but was it difficult to find 4?
No, I mean that's the point. Usually, in fact, we only do 2 of these each year, and the fact is that there were so many good plays and so many plays that we didn't have room for, that we decided, and particularly since we were going online, we decided we would increase it to 4 this year. And that's an indication of the standard. And of course, you see, we read our plays blind. You know, it's only at the very end of the process we know who people are. So when the name Peter Daly came up, I said, surely not the same Peter Daly. Yes, it was.
Well, it's good to know that it has that kind of blind aspect to it. So there's no idea of the people who are in the club will be dealt with here, and we'll get a sense of that anyway when we talk about the other 3 plays. But let's ask Peter to tell us a little bit about 4 days in July. There's a real life historic event at the heart of this, and very very timely in lots of ways in terms of what's happening in America, Peter.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, in 1863, in the middle of the American Civil War, they brought in a draft, and they were going to draft men for the war. It was the first time the draft had ever been brought in America. And the Irish were outraged. They were against the war to begin with because they were fearful that if the blacks were freed, that they would lose their jobs, because they were up against it economically. They'd come over after the famine. There's a line in the play where one of the director, Edward, says, you know, they came over after the famine. They were the lowest of the low. And then there's an actor in the room who's black, who says to him, apart from the blacks, because, you know, they were competing against each other. So when they were going to be drafted, they just said, this is the final straw. So they went down, they drank for the weekend. The men drank in pubs in this incredibly hot New York summer. And on the Monday morning, they went down and they smashed the apparatus of the draft. They smashed it up. Then they went on a 4-day rampage. And they first of all turned their attention to municipal buildings. They burnt them down. They turned their attention to what were known as $300 men, which are people that could buy their way out of the war. They could pay over $300 and not be in the draft at all. And then they turned their attention to black people. And they pulled them out of their houses and they did unspeakable things to them. It's a horrendous story. And I'd never heard it before. I stumbled across it when I was about to go to New York about 6 years ago. And I couldn't believe I'd never heard of this horrible event. And it stuck with me. And I just wanted to tell a story that was about it or had to do with it. And it floated around in my head. And eventually I landed on the idea of a well-meaning, but possibly a director called Edward, who hasn't thought things through. And he's looking for, you know, possibly the latest fad or the latest kind of issue to make a piece of art around. And he hasn't really thought it through in any great detail. And he's been given a group of black and white actors and stage managers to put them in a room for a week or for 4 days to try and make a piece of art about this. And all they have to really do is show a reading of it on the fourth day. Yeah. And as they all get in the room together, nothing works out. They don't know, they can't agree on what language can and can't be used. They get into whose story is this and who has the right to tell this story. Is this an Irish story? Is this a black story? Is the director Edward, is he trying to redeem these Irish people in some way? So yeah, there's a lot of tension straight away. When I found out, put these people in a room together, all that happened was, you know, the tension bubbled up to the top.
Yeah,
I hope that's not characteristic of your more recent experiences.
That was my question to you, Gary. Did you recognise anything in Edward, the virtue signalling director, who hadn't his work done before he came into rehearsals?
Unfortunately, quite a bit.
That idea, Gary, of you know, and I know you're not directing this piece, but obviously you've read it and you've a sense of it. That idea, it's an interesting point that Peter's bringing up. Obviously, the 1863 story in and of itself is horrific, but there is this other aspect going on in Peter's play, which is around who owns what story, who can tell what story.
Yeah.
They're difficult questions to answer.
They are, and they're very current at the moment. You know, so it's extraordinary in a sense that because, like Peter, I didn't know about this story either until I actually read his play and then saw the background to it. And, you know, it's very much an issue in the theatre because you, in a sense, are voicing those characters. So it can be very, very sensitive about whose stories have you the right to tell.
And you're very clear, Peter, and I know we're at the draft stage and you're in development, so, you know, I'm not going to pin you down on any in terms of the specifics, but you are specific in some ways around the ages of the actors, the colour of the actors. How colourblind would you like the director to be in Erin Monaghan? How genderblind would you like him to be in the casting of this? Or do you need it to be as you've described it?
I do. I felt it was important that the ethnicities were respected. There are four white people and there are three black people and one person of colour in the cast of the script. There are four male and there are four female. And after that, there are two characters that I feel need to be from Ireland. And after that, it doesn't matter, you know, where they're from, as long as those ethnicities are kind of, adhered to. But yeah, I felt that was important for this particular, because within the telling of the story, within the workshopping, they try gender blind casting. They, you know, they cast within it, black people can play white people, white and black, male and female, which in some cases works, in some cases confuses the issue further. So the play itself kind of delves into some of the things, you know, so, I thought it was important.
Tell me the truth now. The fact that you have such balanced numbers in terms of gender and in terms of ethnicity, did you strive for that or did the characters dictate that to you? And tell the truth, Peter Daly.
I'm going to be absolutely honest. I started writing it and when the when I realized it was about a piece of theatre, and it was also kind of talking about, for example, there's a bit early on where one of the black actors thinks that there's somebody back at base, somebody in the theatre company that's funding this, has to get their numbers of male and female and black and white people that have worked with them up on their website. And they're trying to do some last minute balancing out before this happens. And when I realized that was happening, I did deliberately go for four and four, male and female and so forth. But like, I didn't do it in a cynical way to get this play put on, because let's face it, I wrote a play for eight people and I'm a more or less first time full length playwright. The chances of this ever making it onto a stage was almost nil. Like, we don't do plays with them. With eight people,
big cast.
We just don't have the money. So yes, but it was a deliberate kind of the mathematical side of my brain was kind of doing a bit of balancing out as I went.
And in terms of how this will be realised, it's over four Thursday nights, Gary, four different plays.
Yep.
They will actually, rehearsals will be done at a distance.
Yeah, at a distance, they will be done over Zoom. It's exactly the exact same process as it would be if it were in the MLT, except it'll all be over Zoom. So it'll be 2 days rehearsal, then a kind of dress rehearsal process, so to speak. I don't know what the Zoom word for that is. And then actually there'll be go out over Zoom at 7:30 on each Thursday night. So over the next month, four different plays by four different writers and four very different plays as well.
Yeah, you might tell me briefly about the one you're directing yourself, just as we finish up.
Yeah, it's called How's Life. It's by a woman called Nina Mitrovic, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing her name accurately. She's Croatian. The production has already been premiered in Zagreb. It came to us again through the open submission process. It's set in a care home, and it's basically about four people coming to the ends of their lives and figuring out what do they make of it? They're trying to figure out the issue of what life is about as they're coming to the end of it. It's an extraordinary piece.
And the fact that it's in a care home, given the pandemic that we're still going through it, but at least we're coming out of it in some way now, that must add an added, there's an added layer to that play then because of that, I think, How's Life?
Absolutely. And then the other two plays are Wall by Edward Lee, which has been directed by Mark Atkinson, and An Honest Woman by Erica Murray, which has been directed by Sarah Joyce.
Well, listen, best of luck to all involved in those Druid debuts. Gary Hines and Peter Daly there speaking to us about them every Thursday from this coming Thursday, the 2nd of July. And in fact, it's the Nina Mitrovic one is happening this Thursday. How's Life? At the Thursday, the 2nd, then with Edward Lee's the following Thursday. Peter Daly's that Peter was speaking to us about is on Thursday, the 16th. And finally, then Erica Murray's on Thursday, the 23rd. All of them at 7:30 p.m. And you can find out full details on druid.ie. 18 minutes to 8 o'clock on Monday Night's Arena. In recent weeks, we've been relieving your wanderlust with our virtual literary travelogues. Colm Tubin took us to Venice with the help of Thomas Mann and others. Last week, Sophie Gorman let us in on her love affair with the Parisian left bank through the works of Gertrude Stein and more. Tonight, our tour guide is journalist and writer Mary McGill, who's taking us on a stroll through the streets and canals of Amsterdam, specifically the streets and canals of Amsterdam during the Dutch Golden Age, because that is the period in which all three of her chosen novels are set. Now, Mary, I know you didn't visit Amsterdam during the Dutch Golden Age, but are you a big fan of the city?
Huge, Sean. Absolutely huge fan of the city. And I think the reason I wanted to focus on these particular books tonight and this particular era is because I think Amsterdam, quite rightly, has a bit of a reputation as a city break destination, a bit of a party town, which is a good thing, of course. But there's actually lots to see if you've got time to spend walking around, watching out for trams and bicycles, of course. And I really wanted to introduce that side of the city to people. And this particular era that I'm talking about is when the Amsterdam that we know today really, really began to take shape. So if you've ever been to Amsterdam, if you've ever seen a postcard of those beautiful houses along the canals, the central canals, a lot of those were built by wealthy merchants who rose to prominence in the city during the 17th century. And they represent a really interesting tension. how the discipline and the work ethic and the kind of thrift that Calvinism was associated with helped propel this massive economic boom that brought the country immense riches. But these riches and this abundance ran very much counter to a very strict religious culture of self-denial. And of course, we can see many of these lovely homes still today standing along the canals, but they're a bit more lopsided now. But I suppose you have that in a city that's built on sand and waterlogged land.
Well, now the three little pigs tell you where you should be building your house. Never mind the Dutch Golden Age. Well, tell you what you build your house off, doesn't it? Anyway, let's not go up that blind alley.
No, indeed.
The Dutch Golden Age, you know, when we talk about that period, I suppose 1580 or thereabouts, the birth of the Dutch Republic through until about a century later is what we're talking about. Did all of the arts grow together at that period, or was there one or other of the arts that came to that rose to the top, or the one that was more the chosen art form?
Oh, that's a great question. During that period, there was great achievement in art, but there was also in Amsterdam and in the Netherlands in general, there was great achievements in trade, there was great achievements in science. This has to do with the work ethic that I just mentioned, the notion of the discipline of the self that I mentioned, and of course, the development of windmills. Windmills were a really cheap and effective way of creating power. So that's really handy when you want to build boats and you want to go off and sail the oceans and create colonies. So you have that going on. I suppose what I think of immediately when you ask that question is art. I immediately think of Rembrandt, you know, and I think of the museum that I presume most people visit when they go to Amsterdam, which is the Rijksmuseum, which is absolutely resplendent, packed from top to bottom with artistic treasures, a lot of which would have come out of that Dutch Golden Age. So I think in lots of respects, there were achievements. But I think for me, when you talk about the art, it is painting, it is Rembrandt, it is Vermeer, it is those paintings that even now when you see them, whether it's the Girl with the Pearl Earring or it's the Night Watch that we'll talk about, you know, they just take your breath away. You know, these new techniques and paintings that the likes of Rembrandt came up with, you know, the light and the depth and all of these things. So for me, it would be painting.
You're right. Well, look, since we've opened up that particular aspect, why don't we stick with the Rembrandt aspect of things? Which is the book that you chose, and easy enough to know that it's about Rembrandt. Rembrandt's Mirror is what we're talking about. Kim Devereaux's 2015 novel. What story is she telling here?
Well, she's telling the story of Rembrandt's life in what is now Jodenbreestraat, which is a street in the city in this area, not too far from the main canals. And it's a story about life in Rembrandt's rather chaotic household. So when the book opens, we are in the midst of when Rembrandt was painting The Night Watch, and this was not a good time for him. This was a time when his wife, Saskia, was dying of what we think was tuberculosis, and he just cannot bring himself really to either be there with her or fully commit to his art. So this is not a good period in Rembrandt's life. His life was a bit chaotic anyway. He was always in debt. He was very unconventional, but of course he was, you know, this unconventionality lends itself to him being an artist. Artistic genius. So in Devereaux's book, we meet a character who is not just a character, you know, she existed as a flesh and blood human being, but of course we don't know her story in the way that we know Rembrandt's story for obvious reasons. But she became his partner after Saskia passed away, and that is a maid by the name of Rijke, Henrika, but Rijke shortened in the book. And she comes from, God love her, this very strict Calvinist family in the countryside, and she comes to Amsterdam and she enters this household, and she is of course appalled because at this stage Rembrandt, you know, he has you know, unconventional working habits anyway, but he's also having an affair quite openly with the housekeeper, and they aren't married, and of course this scandalizes Rijke. You know, this is against everything she is taught to appreciate and observe and all the rest of it. So she is very much taken aback, but she is also very much drawn to the world that Rembrandt inhabits. He's a very singular individual. He's incredibly talented, and he exists in a way that she's never encountered before. He sees the world in ways that she's never experienced before. And as their relationship develops, she becomes romantically involved with him, and she ends up becoming, another significant partner in his life. They can never marry because of his complicated legal affairs, but she stays with him in the book, and indeed in real life, as it were, until her own death. And we think that death was from the plague. So it's a read, and I think all of these books kind of touch on this theme in a way of, you know, young women who are looking for something more and who find in Amsterdam a life in a place that's rapidly changing and rapidly modernising. They find something that they, in Rijke's case, she didn't even realise she was looking for.
Right. I think this is a quote from you and from your notes, Mary. Dark corners, strange passions and a ruthlessness born from his need to put his art first, which would be a great line to sell this book if they're ever looking for somebody to give a bit of copywriting. Now, to what extent do you think, I mean, obviously with the way you've just described the kind of household that he held, we can see that darkness is there and that singularity of mind to put his art first. To what extent do you think Rembrandt is pretty typical of the artistic bent, if you like, of that period? Was that what was expected and what was given by artists up against this very strict Calvinism? And I suppose that was the tension that made the Golden Age so interesting.
I think that's part of it, Sean, but I also think that is some people might call it selfishness, and you can certainly construe it as selfishness, but I think that's part of what it means to be an artist, or at least to be an artist that is utterly committed to the work that they do. Whether we want to talk about that in terms of succeeding financially or all the rest of it, I think we can put that to the side. What I mean is an artist that lives and breathes the work is doing the work that art requires, you know. And I think, I mean, that's certainly true of Rembrandt and his contemporaries and, you know, in this period in history. But I think throughout time, when we look at people who leave the kind of legacy that he did, there is often a preoccupation. And again, you could describe it as selfishness or eccentricity or any of these things. But very often it seems that that is what it takes to produce a body of work that is, you know, I mean, Rembrandt, you know, look at it. It's undeniable. There it is, you know. So, they mightn't be the best human beings, but the art speaks for itself.
Unfortunately, the best human beings don't often make the best artists. Or it would seem that way in many cases, shall I say. Now, let's go then to what is another based on real events type of story that was told. This is the 2016 Costa shortlisted novel, The Words in My Hands by Guinevere Glassford and René Descartes. So we've had the dark corners in the mind of the artist Rembrandt. What kind of René Descartes do we get in Guinevere Glassford's novel?
Would you believe, Sean, they're not that dissimilar? Although
I would believe that.
Mr. Descartes is a bit more honourable, and I'll talk a bit more about what I mean by that in a minute. But he's no less obsessed with his work. I mean, this is a leading figure of the Enlightenment, probably one of the greatest French intellectuals of his era. He comes to Amsterdam to work on, to try and get, you know, away from the busyness and the distractions in France, to work on what will become one of his greatest works, which is Discourse on the Method of Rightly Conducting One's Reason and of Seeking Truth in the Sciences, to give it its full title. So he's a man who is a philosopher, a mathematician. He is in love with knowledge. He's in love with reason. But he also falls in love, in this case, in the book and in real life, with a woman called Helena Jans, who is the maid in the house where he lives, or he stays in Amsterdam. And Helena herself is a very interesting character because she has a love of knowledge and learning that matches his. But of course, it's much harder for her to follow her instincts in that regard than it is for the great Mr. Descartes. So there is a very interesting story in how it develops. Now, Helena's story is obviously very much fictionalised because we don't know a whole lot about her.
Right.
We do know that they certainly had a significant relationship.
The other thing that I think the novel brings to the fore is the idea that, despite the fact that Descartes gave us the line in that famous discourse on the method, etc., 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 he gives us the famous line, "I think, therefore I am."
Mm, yeah.
But this novel suggests that perhaps Helena taught him an awful lot more than we might expect.
Yes, absolutely. She has, I think she teaches him what "I think, therefore I am" implies. It's, you know, this notion of a binary. To think is elevated. He elevates thinking above emotion, right? This rational creature who is usually a man who does, you know, who follows through with logic and reason. What Helena makes him aware of is the power of emotion and how difficult it is to kind of simply say, well, that's thinking and that's emotion, and thinking is superior, emotion is necessarily subservient to that, and we can't trust it. And she herself, I mean, she models this in her own behaviour. It is her emotion and her desire to learn and her love of reading that sees her, for example, use beetroot as ink to practice her writing, because, you know, any other type of education is just not available to her. She writes in secret on her skin. She uses that knowledge then to teach other people, and she uses it to express herself, earn, you know, something of a living when she becomes a single mother with Descartes' child. And she uses it to find out whether her brother is, you know, alive and or dead. He's gone sailing. Back then there was no kind of thing, you know, telecommunication as we know it now. And she gets into the customs house down at the quays in Amsterdam and manages to find the ledger and discover that he's gotten back okay. These little things and her own desire, her own strength of character, which of course is partly emotional, really causes, at least in the book, Descartes to kind of reevaluate certain assumptions that he had about these dynamics.
And while both the books that you've spoken about, and indeed the third one will be to a certain extent, but we are talking about those picture-perfect houses along the banks,
yes,
of the various canals, in your final choice then, The Miniaturist,
yes,
best-selling novel from Jesse Barton, published 2014, we're not just talking about a magnificent house, we're talking about a magnificent doll's house.
Oh, yes. And if anybody has not seen this in the Rijksmuseum, can I just take a look at it, because I think it signifies the ridiculous opulence and yet compelling beauty of this era. So yes, Petronella Ortmann was a real person in the book, and this is her dollhouse. And in the book, she is given it as a kind of a wedding present, post-wedding present, by her husband, who was a wealthy silk salesman by the name of Johann Brandt. But in the book, all is not as it seems. Young Nella is expecting to move to Amsterdam and have a wonderful life, lots of babies with her new husband, but it quickly becomes clear that there are aspects to Johann that she does not understand, although she comes to him. And him giving her this dollhouse is at once infantilizing. I mean, a grown woman, a dollhouse.
Yeah.
It says a lot about the status of women at that time, right? Here's a dollhouse, go and amuse yourself. But it brings her into contact with the miniaturist of the title, although never directly. We never directly get to see them. And this miniaturist seems to have an uncanny ability to foretell strange and dangerous events that are taking place in Nella's house that she does not realise, because the dollhouse is an exact replica of the house that she lives in. So this gets creepier and creepier and creepier. And don't forget, it's set at this really conservative period. There are eyes everywhere. That, you know, the more wealthier you are, people are watching you, they're waiting to catch you out. And it's really a story about how Nella comes to realise, lose her innocence and realise the forces that are at play in this glamorous city she thought she had a fairy book idea of. So,
And indeed, the dollhouse, I suppose it's very difficult not to think of Ibsen, and I know we're at least a century away from it, and his great 19th century play, A Doll's House. But I'm just looking at the three novels, and in all three novels, we are essentially talking about, in all three, we have three young women who come from the countryside. Is there a theme there about the idea of wisdom coming in the way of these young women into the so-called wise and urbane city?
Yes, John, I think there's seeds been sown here. We're 100 years away, a century away from Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, where she calls for and makes uses Enlightenment ideas to appeal for the education of women. And we can see in each of these stories, you know, these young women are so vulnerable, they're so reliant for their employment, for their sustenance on wealthy men. But each of them find a way of asserting their own independence and carving out, whether it's through education, education being key in many respects, with the story of Riken and Helena, of carving out some kind of independence for themselves in a very stifling world that really does not regard them as agents in their own right. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of kind of themes that will continue to become more and more of an issue as the years pass by. Yeah,
and and I'm presuming that we don't normally hear the stories of those Dutch Golden Age women. We hear the stories of the Rembrandts. We hear the stories of the Descartes. I know he's French, but visiting Amsterdam, those are the stories. It's the men's stories that we hear. We don't hear the women's stories.
We don't, Sean, but we stand in the Rijksmuseum and we admire those women's portraits. That's the interesting thing.
And the other thing about that is, I'm not sure which of the houses is near. Is it Descartes' house? Is it Anne Frank's house? Is not far away as well?
Very close by, yeah, very, very close by. You'll know Anne Frank's house by the queue that never leaves outside of it. But yes, probably the best known book to come out of Amsterdam.
Yeah, but three very interesting choices from you this evening. That's Mary McGill. Thanks for that, Mary. And Mary's three books set in Amsterdam are The Words in My Hands by Guinevere Glassford, The Miniaturist by Jessie Burton, and Rembrandt's Mirror by Kim Devereaux. Next Monday, Richard Aldous will give us three books on Berlin. Very difficult to come up with just three, so good luck to him on that one. That is our lot for this evening, however. Mark McGrath was on sound supervision this evening. Research was by Paula Shields, and the broadcast coordinator was Janice Farfey. Tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.